Well, good afternoon. This is not Steve Hallstrom. This is Kim Koppelman sitting in for Steve today, who is taking a well-deserved break. And those of you that may not have any idea who this voice is on the other end of the radio, I am a call myself a recovering legislator. I served in the North Dakota House of Representatives for 28 years, chaired the Judiciary Committee for many of those years. I was Speaker of the House when I retired about 2.5 years ago, and represented West Fargo, most of West Fargo, for all of those years. And I've been in business for about 41 years. I think we just passed that threshold. I'm in the marketing, communications, public relations world, and have worked in that business for that time. It's really good to be here, and I'm honored that Steve frequently asks me to come by and sit in this chair when he's away, and it's an honor to do that. We have a good program lined up for you today, including some guests, and we want to talk about a lot of issues that are really in the news and things that you are probably thinking about. This is kind of drive time on a Friday afternoon. Most of you are probably headed home. I see the interstate highway out our window looking fairly busy. 4 to 6, we'll be with you, and look forward to your comments as well. If you have anything in this show, if you have comments, questions, things that perk some interest in your mind, we invite you to call in on the Valley Christian Counseling phone line, which is 701-271-1100. And again, 701-271-1100. If you want to text us, you can do that as well. That text line is 237-1590, 237-1590. You can also email us at studio@flagfamily.com. Again, studio@flagfamily.com. And those are three different ways you can connect with us and share your thoughts, questions, and so on. And to kick things off today, we actually have a special guest, a gentleman that I just became acquainted with and am pleased to have on with us. His name is Mac Parnell, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Mac. Are you with us?
Oh, you got it, Cam. Of course. Yeah.
All right.
Cam, how's it
great.
Going?
I'm doing well. Thank you. And Mac hails from the state of Georgia, beautiful state. A little too hot and humid most of the year for me, for my taste, but I'm sure we're a little cold for yours, so so I understand that. And Mac, it's great to have you with us. You are with the Georgia Faith and Freedom Coalition, and why don't we begin by just telling us a little more about what that is, and maybe about your own background as well.
Well, that's exactly right, Kim. Thank you so much for having me on. Such a pleasure to connect with you and talk with you. And thank you for your heart for service and your willingness to continue to give back to the cause. We so appreciate that. Okay. And you're right, Georgia's a little bit hot and humid. I actually married a girl who was born in Alaska. Now she's lived in Georgia for 30-plus years. her father was in the Air Force, and so... So she was, of course, used to the colder climates, and we would love to come visit y'all up there in North Dakota. I said North Carolina.
Even further north.
Well, that's right.
We would welcome you, and where we're located, North Dakota is a pretty good sized state. This radio station and where I live is actually on the eastern edge of the state, so we could almost throw a rock and hit Minnesota from here. So we're kind of in that region. The Red River of the North separates the two states, and it's a wonderful part of the world. Great place to live and do business and raise a family and retire, and we brag about that a lot, and we take it to heart. We believe it.
And y'all's economies have been booming. My goodness, what y'all have up there is something special. And unfortunately, Georgia has been the center of the political universe with our newfound status as a swing state. So we always have our hands busy in the political realm. But we have great leadership with Governor Kemp and, of course, our dear friends in the legislature. So you mentioned I'm with the Georgia Faith and Freedom Coalition. That's exactly correct. I'm honored to serve as the executive director. So we do a lot of work in the policy space and in the political space. We do voter education, which is, of course, working with churches and turning out the vote, Christians and conservatives, educating them where the candidates stand on whatever issues are our issues, conservative values, and turning them out to vote. And then we work on policy, both at the state, local, and federal level, ensuring that not only do we win elections, that we actually win the more important thing, which are those policy battles. And we also view it that we are building a culture, because it's not enough just to get the policy wins. You actually have to form the culture so that they will be receptive to those values as well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, you know, and it's interesting. I don't know the lay of the land in Georgia as well as I probably should, although we have a good mutual friend from there who is a former state senator and was a leader nationally in state legislative organizations and so on. And so I know a bit about the state and have some other acquaintances down there, but I would guess that that I can predict or I can guess at what makes Georgia, formerly a red state, pretty solidly now a swing state. And when I say that, I'm looking to the east here, to the state of Minnesota, which most people know as a blue state. But in reality, it's a lot more purple than most people would realize. If you go into the parts of Minnesota that are near the area where we are, they're about as conservative as the North Dakota side. Some would argue maybe a little bit more in some of the areas. And so I always say that I've discovered the cause of liberalism. It's tall buildings. And
that is exactly right.
The Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul, and I'm guessing the same is true of Atlanta in the Georgia, are largely the cause of any liberalism that creeps in and tries to sort of take over the public policy of the state. Is that a fair guess?
That's a very fair guess. And then obviously you see it in the numbers. The more liberal voters in Georgia are concentrated in the metro Atlanta area. There's some pockets in other parts of the state, but it's concentrated in the metro Atlanta area. And really, when you look at the state, about 60-65% of the population is in the metro Atlanta area. Now, obviously, Georgia is actually the largest state east of the Mississippi, so there's a lot of land. We're a large, and our number one business is agriculture and agribusiness.
Sure.
But the population density is there in the city, so that's where a lot of it comes from. I am actually kind of in between where metro Atlanta meets rural Georgia. I live in a small town northwest of Atlanta called Cartersville. That's about halfway to Chattanooga. And so I'm seeing that growth follow the interstate up north to Chattanooga. And so I also think I have hope, too, that we are making a difference in some of these changing hearts and minds and converting people that may have just, well, this is a popular thing, so I'm going to back it, but actually educating people where candidates stand. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we connected about is, of course, our work supporting Israel and the Jewish people. And we've seen tremendous success here in Georgia and really at the national level as well. And so I am excited where things have come to, where we find ourselves today. But there are certainly challenges ahead, and I'd be happy to discuss any of that you want to touch base on.
Absolutely. And, Mac, you know, first of all, before we leave the discussion about your organization, there's an organization in North Dakota called the North Dakota Family Alliance, and they are, I think, probably parallel to what you folks do from the sound of things. I'm actually speaking at a legislative academy that they're sponsoring a week from today, and they do good work here, so I compliment you on that facet of your involvement and so on. But you're right. The reason I invited you on today is because of what's going on over in Israel and the things that we're watching in the news and the things that we see here at home as well. And I want to get into more discussion with that. We're going to have to go to a break shortly here. But before we do, just to kind of set the stage, I know you've been to Israel before, and I've been there twice. I was there in, I believe it was 2019, just before COVID hit. And my wife and I went with a group from a church, so it was a spiritual journey, and loved to see the places where our Savior walked, and the Sea of Galilee, and places like that are just astounding. And I think you leave with a whole different picture of the things we read about in the Bible and so on. But that was a wonderful journey. And then I was invited back in 2023, about 6 months after October 11th. I believe I was there in April. And that was an entirely different journey. We were there with some of the leaders, the government leaders and so on, wonderful briefings from a lot of people. We were within about a half a mile of Gaza, the border. Heard the mortar fire in the distance and the artillery fire and so on, a very very startling experience. Talked and met with families of hostages and really learned a lot about October 7th. And I want to begin with maybe talking a little bit about that as soon as we come back from our break. So stick with us, Matt. Welcome back to the Steve Hallstrom Show. Kim Koppelman sitting in Steve's chair today, and we have a wonderful guest with us, Mac Parnell, who is from the state of Georgia, from the Faith and Freedom Coalition in Georgia. And we have just started talking a little bit about Israel. I was sharing about my experience in visiting Israel, and I just want to talk for a moment about what happened there on October 7th, 2 years ago, because not a lot of people, I don't think, perhaps even recognized the degree to which that was a shock to the nation of Israel, and really the gargantuan, terrible, seminal effect that it had. I heard someone today say, well, that was our 9/11, and or that was their 9/11, rather. And really, that's an understatement. Now, how dare I say that? Because 9/11 obviously was a seminal thing in our country. But on 9/11, in those terrorist attacks, 3,000 people died, and it was awful. Those of you that remember that vividly know what I'm talking about. In Israel, 1,200 people died on October 7th. Well, you may say, well, that's fewer than 9/11. Yes, but when you realize that the nation of Israel is about the size of New Jersey, and that if we were to correlate the number to their population, the number of people that were killed, it would be like 40,000 people in the United States. So think about 9/11, 3,000 people. How would we have responded? You know our response to that as a nation. How would we have responded to a terrorist attack in America that killed 40,000 people? That's the size of many of our cities. And just think, 1,200 people were dead that day in Israel. I think it was roughly 300 that were taken hostage. There was rape, murder, kidnapping, torture, just an unthinkable event. So with that backdrop, thinking about that a little bit, you think about what Israel has been through. Fast forward to today, and Israel's certainly had its degree of criticism in recent months and even years from people that either want to forget about October 7th or pretend as if it never happened. So, Mac, what are your thoughts about that? Now we find ourselves hopefully on the threshold of peace with this situation in Gaza and Hamas going away as the ruling government there. What do you see and what are your observations?
Well, Kim, I just want to be clear about one thing and something that Israel's detractors fail to mention frequently, and that is Hamas violated a ceasefire on October 7th with one of the most brutal, vicious, disgusting attacks that you've ever seen. You mentioned that you were in Israel about 6 months after October 7th. I actually happened to be there just a month after October 7th. I visited a kibbutz called Kfar Aza, and wearing body armor, we saw the destruction. It was still smoldering, and the smell of death permeated the air. And in fact, today, the Trump administration apprehended an October 7th perpetrator, a Hamas operative in the U.S. who actually was what his cell phone data shows him in Kfar Aza.
Indeed.
And that has to do, you know, we're not going to get into border security and the disaster that the Biden administration was, but that's an element there. So you're exactly right. This was a unbelievable impact on the Israeli psyche. And not only that, with them holding the 250 hostages, it was a continual. So it wasn't just 9/11 happens on a day there was an attack, and then this is in perpetuity and the continual rockets. And then also, you mentioned it's the size of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We also need to put in context where the threat is physically, because this is not like Mexico threatening North Dakota. This is the equivalent of Minnesota having 100,000 rockets pointing across the river. I mean, we're talking about less than a kilometer in some cases. That you and I have visited.
Yep.
And so the threat is ever present, and Americans would not tolerate that. We would not tolerate Mexico having missiles pointing at us. I mean, go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, 90 miles off the coast of Miami.
Yeah.
We would not tolerate that, and Israel should not have to tolerate that. And October 7th was a devastating, devastating day, but coming out of it, Israel has had unbelievable military successes that are unimaginable. They have degraded Iran's nuclear capability. They have destroyed the leadership of Hezbollah, which was in Lebanon to the north. Syria has a new regime, and of course, they have degraded significantly the war-making capability of Hamas. Now, the threats are still there. Iran's still in the background. They still want to have their terror network. But Israel, to this point, has almost accomplished everything they can militarily. And now we get towards peace. And I am excited about what the future holds for peace in the Middle East. I have my doubts. The Jerusalem Post did a poll of Israelis, and they said that 71% of Israelis support the peace deal that President Trump, and by the way, we haven't even mentioned it, President Trump deserves a tremendous amount of credit for this peace deal, he and his team. And I got to be honest with you, it was unconventional, but in a conflict like this, it takes unconventional approaches to be successful, and so they deserve a tremendous amount of credit. So I told you that Israel supports the peace deal 71%, but only 12% of Israelis actually think that Hamas will abide by its terms. And unfortunately, we're seeing that play out where Hamas is backing away from certain elements. They're saying, well, we'll turn over. Who are you talking about us demilitarizing to? Who are you talking about us turning our arms over? I rejoice that they have returned the living hostages that we know of. But there are, they have not met the timelines that were laid out to return the deceased hostages. So there's a lot more challenges ahead, and I have hope for the region. I have hope that Israel will enjoy a period of safety and peace and prosperity, and that God has his hand on them. But I also have my doubts, and my doubts lie in Hamas and their willingness to actually abide by any agreement, because they've violated every agreement that they have met so far.
Right. No, and well said. And you know, a lot of the listeners perhaps may not be aware of the actual status of Hamas. What is this thing called Hamas? I mean, Hamas is a terrorist organization. It's not a legitimate government. And people that talk about the Palestinians, you know, we could even debate, you know, the who are they really talking about? Because they're an Arab group, of course, but the Middle East is dominated by Arab nations. And this little sliver called Israel is the only Jewish state in the Middle East, even though it's their homeland. Hamas, they had turned over Gaza to Palestinian rule. Some remember the PLO, Yasser Arafat and those folks. They controlled Gaza until Hamas actually won an election. Whether that was legitimate or not, you could have a discussion about. Several years ago, I don't know, you may know the exact time, and they've simply never called an election since. So you have a terrorist group, a terrorist organization that is literally running this little area. Really a part of Israel. Gaza is a portion of Israel. And then the terrorist group, you know, attacked Israel from the tunnels that they build. And we could go into detail. I won't take the time for that, but about how that occurred and so on. But so that puts us on the threshold of this potential peace deal. As you mentioned, Mac, they have already violated the terms. I think we all hope that somehow peace will be sustained. But they were also doing they had agreed to disarm as part of their the agreement that President Trump helped fashion, and yet they were committing public executions not long after that in Gaza. So it really makes you wonder. Now I heard recently that some of the bodies that have been returned, ostensibly hostages' bodies, have now been identified as not belonging to hostages. So they might be returning corpses that are not even the loved ones of the people who have been mourning those that have been taken hostage and presumably killed. You mentioned that there was the FBI has arrested a gentleman, and I was going to talk about that as well, who has been identified as an October 7th Hamas or a terrorist, participated in the Hamas terrorist attacks. Today in Lafayette, Indiana, Mahmoud Amatadi, I think is how he pronounces or how you pronounce that name. And, you know, with our porous borders, which, as you said, is a whole different topic, we have been, you know, apparently an area that is pretty easy to come to for people all over the world. Apparently he lied on his visa from the report that I heard, but he could have just as easily waltzed across the border in recent years. And who knows how many others are here, which leads into a whole other topic, which we may give some time to if we're able. But the other thing I want to pivot to real quickly is the plight of the Jewish people, and what I see as a an kind of an almost an inexplicable rise or at least awareness of anti-Semitism in our country. And I don't know what you've experienced in Georgia on your college and university campuses there, for example, but even here in North Dakota and Minnesota and really around our state, around our nation rather, I saw a groundswell of anti-Semitism that I had no idea existed. I mean, I knew anti-Semitism existed, but I had no idea it was as large and apparently as broad an attitude that it seems to be. What do you observe about that, Mac?
Studies have shown anti-Semitism is rising globally, including here in the U.S. Now, thankfully, our university system, we have great leadership. The former governor, Sonny Perdue, leads the Georgia University system, mm-hmm. and he's done a tremendous job responding, respecting First Amendment rights, but also making sure that these things are contained and they don't mm-hmm. turn violent. There we have a few private institutions. I'll call one out in specifically Emory University, that are not in the university system of Georgia, that there's been some disgusting actions there. Mm-hmm. So of course things are not perfect, but comparatively to other places, we are very blessed with the leadership we have in our state, from Governor Kemp, Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, and of course Attorney General Chris Carr as well. And then quite frankly, our legislature has taken a lead. We championed a bill, House Bill 30. It was a simple bill, and all it was adopting the IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, their definition of what anti-Semitism is, so that when that there will actually be something that they can refer to of, is this a question of anti-Semitism? There's mm-hmm. a definition that is accepted in dozens and dozens of countries. It's multiple states use this definition. The federal government uses this definition. Definition of anti-Semitism, and some of the ugly things that we saw in the fight just for that simple advancement were unbelievable. And I know we have deeper issues with that, but we were excited to get that bill across the finish line and a number of other resolutions and things, and Governor Kemp buying Israel bonds quickly after October 7th as a show of solidarity. So we've had success here, and then also the emergency security assistance that we advocated for at the federal level, mm-hmm. and the continued cooperative missile defense program and security assistance, and really the investment that we get. I live in Georgia. I live in Northwest Georgia, probably about 15 miles from a Lockheed plant at Dobbins Air Reserve Base. And they make the center wing component of the F-35 and the C-130J Hercules transport aircraft. And Israel is a huge purchaser of that. Mm-hmm. And that's actually where our funding goes. It's not just a blank check that we give to Israel. It is actually spent, the vast majority of it, I think it's up to 90%, is actually spent back here in the U.S. So I'm sure even in North Dakota there are manufacturers that are a part of that. As well. So I'm encouraged. I still have my doubts as to Hamas's willingness to actually be a good faith negotiating partner, because they mm-hmm. have just never been that. But here in the U.S., people calling out anti-Semitism, standing with the Jewish people is vitally important, and we're honored to be leading in that fight.
Well, that's great. And I appreciate your comments and your being with us today. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not Jewish either by heritage nor by religion. I'm a Christian and I'm of European descent, so I'm not. But I have a great soft spot in my heart for the Jewish people, and America is, I think, clearly Israel's greatest ally, and certainly Israel is our greatest ally in the Middle East, and I think we need to keep that in mind and in our support for Israel. Now, it's not to say that we don't care about Palestinians and other people. But, I mean, I will stand in support of Israel, and I can tell from talking with you, you feel the same way. So, Mac, we really appreciate you being with us today. We need to go to a break, but thank you, sir, for spending the time, and maybe we'll get a chance to do this again sometime soon.
All right. God bless you, Kim. God bless America. Thanks. You so much, Kim.
You too. Welcome back to the Steve Hallstrom Show. Kim Koppelman sitting in Steve's chair today, and honored to be asked to fill in once in a while. We've just finished up with an excellent guest, Mac Parnell, who is with the Georgia Faith and Freedom Coalition, and had a lot to say about Israel. He's got a great familiarity with Israel and what's going on there. As we talked about that, we talked about the fact that the FBI has arrested an alleged October 7th terrorist who apparently participated with Hamas in that tragedy in Israel, and they arrested him in Lafayette, Indiana today, Mohammed Matadi, I believe is his name, and what a terrible event that was. And, of course, that raises questions about our southern border, which I know many of us have, and we've talked a lot about that as well. The news report that I heard said that he had misrepresented or lied on his visa application, which is why he was here. But he may have well just as well walked across the border, as we talked about. And we got a text, Larry texted in saying, why wouldn't we use our military's non-lethal active denial system to enforce our southern border? Stops everyone in their tracks and does no harm. Well, I think that makes sense. I'm not as familiar with that system as maybe Larry is. If he called in, we could talk about that. But certainly, I think this president is willing to, to call it an invasion, which he has, and talk about the fact that part of his job is to defend our country. And whether that's a foreign military streaming across our border, we know that's not how terrorists work. They slip in and do things later. And so, not saying that everyone that crosses the border has that intention. We know some people come here for the promise of America, and we laud that. Immigration is a great thing, but we believe you need to do it the right way and the legal way. And if you think that's too tough, then work to change our laws and make it change the process or the system. But don't just come in. And particularly if you have evil intent, and as we know, many of the people being stopped and arrested are illegal immigrants, and are not only that, but are criminals committing other crimes, and that's something certainly that we all need to be aware of and stand against. We can get more into that later, but we have someone on the phone here with us who I wanted to chat with a little bit because of the good work she's doing and her organization is doing, and her name is Jennifer Benson. She's the executive director of American Experiment North Dakota. And full disclosure, when I retired from the legislature about 2.5 years ago, I was asked to be on the board of this new operation called American Experiment North Dakota, and agreed to do that and have enjoyed doing that. It's an offshoot of an organization in Minnesota called Center of the American Experiment, which is essentially a right-of-center or conservative think tank in the state of Minnesota. And here in North Dakota, we call ourselves, they call themselves North Dakota's think tank. Back in March, they asked me to become a policy fellow in North Dakota, which I do on a very part-time basis, but I love doing it. It involves some policy analysis, some writing, and that sort of thing. And in Minnesota, there are several policy fellows, which also come across the border in North Dakota and do some issue and policy analysis on various things here in our state, and we appreciate their expertise. We've got economists, education experts, energy experts, healthcare, education, right on down the line, criminal justice, public policy, public safety, people that are really very well schooled and very knowledgeable in all of these areas. I'm more of a generalist because of my experience in the legislature and so on with a lot of these policy areas, and they are specialists in one area or the other. But we enjoy working with them as well, and I'm honored to kind of fill the gap in North Dakota for sort of an overview of what we do here. So, Jennifer, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Tim. Yes, I appreciate it. And I always enjoy our conversations in this opportunity we get to have with fellow North Dakotans. So Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, thanks. Mm-hmm. And Scott Hennon just popped in the studio and said a few nice things, too. So both about the show today and also about the organization. So that's nice to hear.
That's great. And you just had a great speaker on, too, and it had me thinking about all sorts of things.
I'm sure.
The great work that they're doing, and it reminded me of last week we were at TPUSA event with Glenn Beck, and the messages were, somewhat similar there.
Yes,
so, important message.
And we were there together along with a lot of other people. The Chester Fritz was packed. I mean, I don't know if I've ever been in that auditorium before. I did not attend UND. My wife did, but. I mean, it's got two balconies. It's a huge facility, and it was packed to the gills as far as I could tell. And and Israel and the war in Gaza, over Gaza, did come up. Mm-hmm. And varying opinions, I think overwhelmingly people were supportive, but there were a couple there that weren't. So, mm-hmm. and we, hey, mm-hmm. free speech is one of our treasured rights
exactly.
in this country.
And that was absolutely, I mean, that was one of the things that, you know, Glenn Beck really emphasized, and certainly Charlie Kirk did as well, is really when, I think he said, when people stop talking is when we get violence.
Yeah.
And
did say that.
So just, yep, absolutely. Reinforcing that. And another thing that struck me that he said was that if we don't have God at our center, nothing will hold.
Right.
And I don't know if you remember that, but I think that it resonated with me. And I think so many others, hence why we're seeing packed houses at
absolutely.
Our universities.
And, you know, yes, it's interesting. So. I think, and I'm a Christian, I'm a man of faith. I know you are as well. You're a Christian. And, faith is at the center of our lives, I think, and it certainly became that with Charlie as well. His story is that he became a believer at a young age, but I think his level of faith increased throughout his career. I had the occasion to meet him many years ago when he was just kind of starting out, and I watched his organization from afar kind of grow. I was on a board of a group in Washington, D.C., and we had a dinner with him when he was very young, just beginning. Had this crazy idea about trying to reach his generation with a sort of a right-of-center message, a conservative message. And then as he continued, over the years, he began talking more and more about what you just mentioned, about faith and about putting mm-hmm. God at the center of his life. And he would do that on college campuses where it probably wasn't a very common thing to hear. And, you know, he'd be talking about some obscure political or ideological issue, and he'd say, well, the first thing you need to do is get Jesus in your life and make sure you're centered on that. Okay. I mean, and just, I think a lot of people would just kind of taken aback by that, but it was wonderful that he had the courage to do that. A lot of people shirk mm-hmm. from doing that. And he talked about the two things that we're told we shouldn't, politics and religion,
that's
but he was not afraid to do that.
That's right. mm-hmm.
So Jen,
that's right, and we shouldn't be afraid. So
that's
yeah.
right. So
yeah,
Jennifer,
go ahead. You're going to ask me a question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was just going to say, and we're going to need to go to a break here in a moment, but just give us a brief introduction, and then we'll come back after the break. But a little bit about
sure.
really what you're doing yeah. with the American Experiment in North Dakota, briefly.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And you gave it, you know, a good kind of background on some of the areas that our policy fellows dive into. But you know, just for audiences that maybe. Joining us or not familiar to the organization, really, you know, American Experiment North Dakota, we are a nonprofit organization, and we work to craft solutions really that emphasize free enterprise. And so limited government, personal responsibility, government accountability, all the good stuff, all the common sense sort of approaches, right, for a conservative organization. And that's our focus. And so in North Dakota, yes, there are many things keeping us busy.
So that's a great
interim and,
that's a great way mm-hmm. to kind of lay out the overall picture. Let's yes. let people think about that for a moment. Come back after our break and
okay.
then drill down on some of those specifics. Welcome back to the Steve Hallstrom Show. Kim Koppelman guest hosting today, and we have with us a special guest, Jennifer Benson with American Experiment North Dakota, and she and I were both laying out a little bit about what that organization is and what it's about, and we'd like to know more, Jennifer, about the specifics of what you're doing in North Dakota, and
yes,
and what are you seeing, what are you participating in, and so on.
Yes, you bet. Well, I'll just jump right in then, if that's okay.
Yes.
And highlight specifically some of the work that we're continuing and working on now related to educational opportunities and trying to open up the market around school choice and the importance and the, you know, really doing some myth busting, you know. And so we've partnered with other national organizations that share this same goal and have worked in all other states as well and had successes there, and EdChoice being one of them, AFP being another. And one of the things that we have just launched this month is a monthly Zoom sort of webinar opportunity for lawmakers to join join in and ask questions related to anything educational choice, what's worked, what other policies exist in other states, what does that look like, how could we deploy and customize it here for North Dakota students. And, you know, I think it's important to, the message here is we have 130,000 kiddos, students in North Dakota, and K through 12. And really, it's our responsibility to, you know, strive to meet the need of every single student. And and our organization, along with these other organizations, it's not just our opinion. It's really, you know, we have the data there to support this narrative that a better way to reach the need of all of these kids is to open up the market. And we do this in so many other arenas, you know, it's capitalism, sort of 101. And so if we allow that to happen and open up this market, we see things that we might never know nothing, that we might not know anything about, like i.e. micro schools, that are very successful in other states and in rural states. And, you know, what opportunities could those bring for our students here? And those type of innovations, if we open up, you know, this strict sort of thing that we have going on in North Dakota, if we open those things up, those are the types of things that will that we'll see be created. And you know, that we'll see more small business. And so those are the types of things that we're working on related to education. It's, you know, it is, there's lots of work to be done there, and there's lots of work that to be built on.
And Jennifer, I know that,
as you know,
and I know that most people in North Dakota are supporters of our public education system, and as are we, as am I. I'm a product of public schools. I think you are too. And just for our audience's knowledge, Jennifer is a former Fargo school public school board member as well. So she's got a lot of experience in that realm. And so I think people jump to the conclusion that as soon as you talk about school choice, you are saying that you know, that you somehow don't like public education, but that isn't true. It's just a matter of offering opportunities and choices to people, correct?
That 100%. Yes, and I'm glad that you made that point for sure. It is, the reality is the vast majority of our students will stay in a public school. And what I think is really great that we can point to the data that says not only is opening up the market good for the students whose needs aren't necessarily being met in the best way under the current structure that we have, but it also lifts all boats. So it lifts what the results and the data are showing in other states is students in public schools then do better. And so it goes back to that whole notion of like competition, right?
Right. And I've been told that
breeds innovation and
I've been told that North Dakota has the least I guess we have no school choice really, and that we are the only state in the nation that doesn't have any type of it. And there was a school choice bill passed in the legislature this past year, and this past session this year. And unfortunately, it was vetoed by the governor, and there weren't the requisite two-thirds votes in both chambers in order to override the veto. So I guess the legislature is stuck with trying to climb that hill again in about a year and a half.
I
suspect they will. But you talked about, you know, one of the pushbacks that I get, and of course, school choice in a metropolitan area where we're sitting right now, an area like the Fargo, West Fargo area, would involve basically allowing, there are several private schools, for example, so people think about that, and allowing those students, and people say, well, shoot, you can send your kids to private school, what's the problem? Well, a lot of people can't afford the tuition, and yet they're paying the taxes at the same time to support the public school, so it's finding a way to make that affordable for people is really the issue. And then the rural areas push back and say, well, gee, we don't have a private school. We don't have any school choice, even if we had the dollars to send our kids to one. And you mentioned something unique that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. You mentioned micro schools. Tell us quickly what that is.
So, you know, the best way to describe a micro school is think back to when COVID, when the school shut down and parents were forced to sort of look at it through, you know, a different lens that they had never even imagined. And they maybe a neighborhood got together, a neighborhood of friends, and they thought, we need to do something. Our kids, we need to offer them some sort of instruction during the day. They can't just do nothing, and we can't do it independently one-on-one because we either work or whatever reason. And so they hired a teacher. And they got together, and they had these, you know, it's like the one-room classroom sort of style. Think back, you know, and how that worked. And so you had 10 kids, and they got together and hired a teacher, and they learned, you know. And so there, it's like things that we have not even necessarily imagined or thought of, right, that have either become possible in other states that have opened this up, and maybe even things that we haven't even seen yet would would be allowed once we allow the dollar to follow the student and stop just protecting the institution. And
yeah,
I would
well
say
said.
In North Dakota, you know, really our teachers union has a really strong hold here, and mm-hmm. they do, you know, consistent, it feels like daily, year-round messaging around these, you know, narratives that unfortunately are not what's best for all kids.
Kind of reminds me of
really about protecting the institution.
You know, during mm-hmm. the Black Lives Matter, the height of that whole movement, people were denigrated for saying all lives matter. Well, of course, black lives mm-hmm. do matter, but so do all lives. And mm-hmm. I see signs right. now saying we support our public schools. And I say, that's great. I support mm-hmm. our public schools, too.
Yes,
but I also
totally.
Support private schools mm-hmm. and the right of people to be part of them.
Yes. And, you know, what's also missing in this conversation is what about the teachers?
Yeah,
you know, not
absolutely.
Every school or not every administrator is a great fit for the teacher. By
yep.
opening it up, think of the ideas these teachers could deploy.
Absolutely.
Or other settings that they could work in. I just think it would be good for everyone
yes.
if we had, you know, educational opportunities beyond just what
right.
exists.
Well, the time today. Goes so fast, Jennifer. I want to thank you for being with us. Go to the website, AmericanExperimentND.org, and education is just one of the issues we're talking about there. And thanks, Jennifer, for being with us. We appreciate it. Back in a moment. Well, welcome back to the Steve Hallstrom Show. This is Kim Koppelman sitting in for Steve today, and privileged to do that. Recovering legislator, businessman, and someone who is a native North Dakotan, raised his family here, have lived here all my life, and love our state. And we had a couple of wonderful guests on in the first hour. Mac Parnell with the Georgia Faith and Freedom Coalition. And we talked about a lot of things relating especially to not only his work there, but also Israel, the pending potential peace deal right now, and how that's going between Israel and Hamas to end the war in Gaza. And we talked about October 7th and that attack and what led to all of this. We also talked with Jennifer Benson with American Experiment North Dakota and about the work they're doing there, especially some thoughts about school choice and some issues she's very interested in. And in this hour, we've got a special guest as well, an old friend of mine, old colleague of mine, who is the Senate Majority Leader in North Dakota and also the Chairman of Legislative Management during the interim, which is a very important role during this window of time when the legislature isn't in session. And that is David Hoag, who by profession is an attorney and hails from Minot, and he's a good friend. David, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kim. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And you're a busy guy. I know you're busy in your real life, your real world, but you're also a busy guy, especially with the hats you wear when the legislature is even not in session. So I wanted to invite you to come and just chat with us a little bit about that. It's been a couple months, I think, probably since we've done this. And you've been, a lot of water has flowed over the dam, as they say, during that time. How are things going in the great state of North Dakota in your estimation?
Well, that metaphor is not quite. I hope no water's flowing over the dam. We've got a lot of water that's flowing, and by that I mean a lot of interim committee work that's flowing, and so things are going well.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we're always, you know, our budget cycle is a 2-year budget cycle, so we always keep an eye on commodity prices, and that mm-hmm. if you're a legislator and you're part of the budgeting process, that you always this time of year you always are paying attention to that, because we're in that no man's land where you just sort of tried to forecast what the price of commodities is going to be for the next 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're off by a little bit, that's okay, but if you're off by a lot, it can create issues for the state. So, but yeah, the water in the reservoir is still being held back at the dam, so. And we're not shut down either.
Yeah, how about that? Well, that raises a couple of issues. One is, you know, this whole government shutdown business. Of course, that's obviously on the federal level, but it affects us all. And mm-hmm. I think, pardon me, had to grab a cough there quickly. I think in North Dakota, certainly we have a lot of federal employees in various mm-hmm. various roles, but because of our military bases and other, you know, other federal entities that operate in our state, like many others. But one of the things that makes us rather unique, I think, is what to his credit, I I kind of jabbed our governor a little bit, our good friend Kelly Armstrong, during the last hour about his veto of the school choice bill, because we had Jennifer Benson on, and I know she was working very hard. American mm-hmm. Experiment North Dakota was working hard to get that passed, and of mm-hmm. course there were not the votes to override the veto. But I've critiqued him a bit, a time or two, but I also want to pat him on the back when he does good things. And I think it's very insightful for following his lead. The Industrial Commission, as I understand it, approved an idea to allow federal employees who might be affected by the federal government shutdown to receive yeah. low-interest loans through the Bank of North Dakota so they can keep body and soul together, pay their bills until their paycheck comes in. And I thought that was really a unique way to approach it.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the main advantages of the Bank of North Dakota. It's, mm-hmm. Its mission is to serve the state and to serve the people of North Dakota.
Right.
You know, it started off as a sort of a state-owned bank that would help advance the interests of farmers and ranchers back at the time of its creation. But it mm-hmm. has over the years been used for a wide variety of purposes that benefit North Dakotans. I know, you know, during the 2011 flood, there was a need to provide some gap lending for folks who didn't always qualify for the federal programs. And so the Bank of North Dakota stepped up. And this one concerning federal employees who are furloughed without a paycheck, I think, is another great mm-hmm. example of mm-hmm. an appropriate use for Bank of North Dakota loans. Hopefully they won't need to draw upon it, but here we sit, you know, I don't know what it is, 15, 16 days and, mm-hmm. and a pay period has gone by now. So, you know, people still have to pay their bills.
That's right.
But who knows how long it'll continue too.
Right. Well, and you know, it's interesting. I was on a call today with a Zoom call with a national commission that I serve on. And, one of the people on the call was a legislator from West Virginia. And, I mentioned this factor, and he said, mm-hmm. you know, he said, I've been trying to convince the people in our state to create a bank like you have in North Dakota. He said, I think it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of folks, I get some pushback. People say, well, that's kind of a socialistic institution. And to be honest, mm-hmm. it probably had those leanings when it was formed back in the Depression era. But as you point out, it's become a very useful catalyst and economic engine almost in our state. And, of course, right now in recent years we've had a lot of money as a result of the oil boom and some of the revenue that flows in from that, among other things. And but I remember, and this is probably even before your time in the legislature, David, but I remember the days when we didn't have much money. And I was serving on the Appropriations Right. Committee, and it was a godsend that the Bank of North Dakota would turn over some profits to the state general fund that allowed us to keep body and soul together during those times. So it's, yeah. you know, it's yeah. kind of... And it's kind of become an economic engine for the state, but also a bank's bank, you know, so the small town banks that might want to finance a project but can't quite swing it themselves and through various programs, the bank can step in on those kinds of things and so on. So you make a good point.
Yeah, no, it's this great collaboration and partnerships between the bank and the private banking sector. I mean, there's the bank is probably the Bank of North Dakota and the Industrial Commission is probably the first to ask the question of whether whatever activity they engage in, whether it will adversely affect the private banking sector.
Right.
And when the private sector is filling the need, the Bank of North Dakota does not try to step into that area. And that's why, you know, as Correct. An example, you don't see the Bank of North Dakota out there trying to get deposits from
right.
individuals.
Right.
They don't do that.
Yep.
And like you said, they it's more of a what I would describe as a gap filling mm-hmm. Approach where they will go into an area where the private sector cannot fill the entire marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, speaking of this government shutdown, I actually wrote a piece, and it's published on the internet at AmericanExperimentND.org. And the when this government shutdown was looming but had not yet occurred, and I entitled it "What if the government shut down and nobody noticed?" And it was interesting because the gentleman that I referred to earlier from West Virginia, who lives in an area of West Virginia that almost borders D.C., you know, in the kind of the federal enclave mm-hmm. out there. He said, you know, he has a lot of military folks and other people that are federal employees and so on in his area and his district. He said, but nobody's complaining. He said, it's not. He said, this is a media event. And I think to a great degree, that's true. I mean, are there little ripples and bumps in the road? Yeah. But the Chicken Little sky is falling story I hear on the evening news is not, I don't think, what most of the country is experiencing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's largely the initial impacts are not dramatic. Of course, as we get farther into the shutdown, mm-hmm. the impacts will be far greater.
Correct.
I know you'll see significant disruptions to air travel.
Mm-hmm.
I know you'll see disruptions to, you know, even like I was talking to a couple folks who are associated with FSA that mm-hmm. administers our farm programs,
mm-hmm.
and it'll impact that.
Sure.
I've talked to people in the federal judiciary, and it's impacted them,
mm-hmm.
Although I think they have special exemptions too.
Sure.
But, yeah. I think the longer it goes, the more severe the impacts.
Sure. But it does raise the question of how much of what the federal government does is really essential. In other words, how much of it really touches the everyday lives mm-hmm. of most of Americans. And we'll talk more about that and some other things, but we have to go to a break right now. So stick with us, David. We'll be back shortly. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the Steve Hallstrom Show. Kim Koppelman guest hosting today on a beautiful sunny afternoon after a little bit of a rainy week here in the Red River Valley of the North. So we are looking out at the interstate highway and seeing a lot of traffic. I guess I used to call it rush minute in the Fargo and West Fargo area, but I guess it's rush hour now. We've grown a little bit, but beautiful day and wonderful program today. We've got with us right now Senator David Hogue, who is the Senate Majority Leader in North Dakota, also the Chairman of Legislative Management, which means he's got a big role and has a lot of hats to wear, a lot of balls to juggle. And we appreciate him taking the time to be with us and appreciate the work he's doing. David, we were talking earlier about the government shutdown and different things, and you'd also mentioned something about trying to forecast commodity prices, which, of course, is a necessary part of the appropriations planning process in North Dakota and so on. And I think one thing that's I think we'd all agree, like them or not, is probably affecting that or making that as unpredictable as it is right now are the tariffs that the president is issuing and retracting and reissuing and the changes that go on day to day almost. And I'm hearing from some farmers that the ones I'm talking to are not alarmed. They're not destitute. They're saying we've got our crop off the field. It's a good crop. We're gonna market it later, not right now, because of where prices are. But you know, apparently not everyone can do that. And the question is, I mean, how do you think this is affecting our state overall?
Well, that's a good question, Kim. I think it's still a little bit too early to tell in terms of the tariffs. You mentioned you know, the soybean farmers. So I think soybeans were around $9, maybe a little under $9, and that's probably too low for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, last time, the last Trump presidency, you know, President Trump imposed tariffs that had impacts on commodity prices.
Yep.
But he made an effort to make them whole, and he's doing the same thing this time around.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not especially concerned about that. I guess we'll have to see what the solution is. But
mm-hmm.
You know, long term, if his plan is to bring manufacturing home, mm-hmm. if his plan is to try to make producers whole in the short term while there's the short-term pain, I think most people are going to be willing to support that.
Mm-hmm. And that raises...
As we saw it during COVID when we, you know, when we don't have, like, you know, I don't think people realize all of our pharmaceuticals are manufactured, a substantial portion of them are manufactured over in China
mm-hmm.
and Southeast Asia, and we don't have control of the manufacturing process for a lot of our very vital pharmaceuticals.
Absolutely. That's a good example. Another, of course, is rare earth minerals, the things that we need for, you know, some of our technological products and operations, which we need for some of our military military institutions and military weapons and all the other things that we use those things for. So it becomes a really, really critical thing. And, you know, I laud the president for what he's doing. I think it does lead to a little bit of uncertainty and unease among some. And I have to confess, I struggled a little bit with the whole tariff issue because I've traditionally kind of been a free trade guy, and I suspect maybe you have too, and I think most people who are lean, maybe a little right of center and are free market people kind of think that way. It's sort of like, why should we have tariffs and do all this artificial manipulation of marketplaces? But I remember, you know, during the when NAFTA was passed and when all these other free trade agreements were entered into, the pushback from the left, from people, you know, our friends on the left side of the ideological spectrum, was, well, free trade is great, but you got to have fair trade too. And at the time, I think a lot of people kind of brushed that objection off or away, but I think that's essentially what we're talking about right now, because what I think does make some sense is to say, in a perfect world, in a level playing field, yes, absolutely, let the market reign. Let free trade abound. But when you have other countries, you know, as right. President Trump frequently talks about ripping us off, and to use his phrase, you know, where they're putting high tariffs on the products that we could sell into their markets, and right. we are not putting a tariff at all or a very low one on their products coming in, there has to be some reckoning of that and some evening of that process. And I think, you know, I think he's attempting to do that. I think what unnerves some, including maybe we see some of the gyrations in the stock market, although I see it's very healthily up again today and this week. But, you know, is the uncertainty. One thing markets hate is uncertainty. And when you talk about, well, we're going to put a tariff of this much on this country next Tuesday if they don't do X, and then Tuesday approaches and they haven't done X, and they, oh, we're extending that for another 30 days or whatever, and then, oh, no, we're going to change it to this. You know, I think that's what unnerves a lot of people, but understanding who our president is, I mean, that's his MO. That's his style. He's a negotiator. It's the art of the deal, and that's the way he rolls.
Yeah, he's very back and forth. And I, with respect to the tariffs, you know, I honestly don't focus as much on the short-term market reaction as I do on, you know, what does it do to inflation? Because when you see, you know, if you see a Walmart, you know, come out at the top corporate level and say, you know, these tariffs are going to require us to raise our prices X amount, that's more concerning to me because, you know, we've been battered by inflation, high inflation, for several years now. And let's face it, Walmart is the top retailer. And in groceries and in other, you know, consumer goods. And so when they say that their prices are going to go up, I'm thinking, well, that's going to have an impact on inflation. And that's the concern for me.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And, you know, I know also that this president has been making an effort to bring inflation under control. We suffered with, you know, some huge spikes in inflation during the last administration, the previous one. And but, you know, we'd love it to settle down quicker and to a greater degree, as you point out. One of the things that is on a lot of people's minds, I think, today, we talked earlier about terrorism in Israel in our previous hour and what's going on over there, and also the things that are happening here. I don't know if you heard the story, but today the FBI has arrested an individual in Lafayette, Indiana, that they believe was an October 7th Hamas terrorist. And you wonder how many of these folks have made their way into our country, and how and what that means. And you look at what ICE is doing, the immigration and enforcement folks, the immigration, I'm trying to remember what ICE stands for, immigration control and enforcement, I believe. And you think about, you know, there are cities, and we don't experience this in North Dakota, thank goodness, but there are places where, you know, there's a high concentration of illegal immigrants. And in some of those blue states, the states, the governors and others are trying to prevent them from being deported and captured and so on. And so ICE is resorting to some tactics that some people object to, and you see some pretty dicey protests in the streets and so on. And you know, I'm thankful that we aren't really experiencing that in our part of the world. But it, you know, the red states that are seem to be inviting, inviting not only ICE but even the National Guard in to help if they're a high crime-ridden city, and then of course some protest against that. And I realize it's more of a national issue, but it could touch on the state level. So I'm just curious what your observations are on all of that.
Well, I'm pretty sympathetic to the Trump administration because I think they inherited a problem that now they're being asked and want to solve, and they're getting all the political blowback for trying to fix the problem. So you open up the border, you have an additional 10 million illegal aliens come into this country. You haven't vetted them at all. And so I wasn't aware of what you described about one of the people they picked up in Indiana being part of the October 7th attacks. It's not surprising to me. I mean, when you don't vet people coming into our country, you're gonna attract the wrong element. And so now there's protests in some of the, you know, the Chicagos, the Portlands. And they're saying, you know, you're just picking people off the street, and they have no idea what these people's backgrounds are.
Right.
And so it's like ICE is getting the bad rap, but they're just being they're just fulfilling their mission, which is to try to determine who is in this country illegally, detain them, and deport them. And why are they being singled out for doing their job, which, you know, they've been around for a long time. But the problem is you have, like I said, you had an additional 10 million or so illegals come into this country uncontrolled.
Right.
And now all of a sudden it's, you know, people are saying, well, this is just, you know, vigilante justice, and they're being arbitrary in who they detain. I don't think that's the case. So, you know, both the media and some of the Democrat mayors are objecting, but I think their objection is without any legitimacy.
Right. Well, David, Senator Hoag, please hang on with us. We'll go through this break and then continue in the next half hour. So we have Senator David Hoag with us, and stay tuned. Welcome back to the Steve Hallstrom Show. Kim Koppelman, guest hosting today. And our guest this hour is Senator David Hoag, the Senate Majority Leader in North Dakota, and also the Chairman of Legislative Management, which sort of oversees the legislative business when the legislature is not in session. And David's an old friend and colleague of mine, and I appreciate him being with us today. So, David, we were talking about some of the issues with ICE and with some of the protests that they're encountering in some areas. And in the gentleman I mentioned, maybe gentleman is not the word to use, but the individual who was apprehended and arrested in Lafayette, Indiana today, I believe his name is Mahmoud Matadi, and the FBI believes that he was, and I assume the CIA is part of this as well, believes that he was part of the terrorist attack marshaled by Hamas against Israel on October 7th in 2023, 2 years ago. So it's interesting that someone like that is in our country. The news report I heard said that he had lied on his visa, and that's how he got here, but he very well could have just waltzed across the border during some of our recent years. And so I, for one, think it's a good thing that that ICE is doing its work and rounding folks up. And, you know, some say, well, these are just people that want part of the American dream. They're immigrants, like some of our forebears and our ancestors, and they're coming in. And, you know, some of them may be that just are desperately seeking that kind of life. However, they should do it legally. And some say, well, they don't like the legal process. It takes too long. Well, that's why you try to change laws, if that's the case. And we're both intimately familiar with that process on the state level and similar on the federal level. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was thinking the timing of his arrest and detention is probably unfortunate because, you know, like he's going to miss the No Kings rally tomorrow, for example. they probably decided they just couldn't wait a day. But you know,
well, I heard
the way it goes, I guess.
You know, I heard one opinion that's, you know, they deport a lot of these folks that that are here illegally to other nations, and maybe Israel wouldn't be a bad place to deport him to. let him face the music over there. I don't know
how that process works.
But at any rate, we are And we shouldn't really take it lightly, because in states like ours, I think an increasingly high number of people, probably a larger number of people than ever, are trying to gain entry into this country through our northern border, which is in our backyard, obviously in North Dakota. And because there's now so much focus on the southern border that I think we're hearing blips here and there of people trying to come in the other way. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I haven't. But, you know, most people don't realize how open our border is. It's a long border, right?
Correct.
And, you know, there's folks that, you know, there's a lot of dirt roads out there. There's not a river separating, at least along the plain states, that separates Canada and the United States. So it's traditionally been, you know, a border that's, you know, not, I won't say porous, but I mean, it's pretty mm-hmm. easy to go back and forth.
Yeah.
And there are folks that have lake cabins and all kinds of other properties that go on both sides of the border. So it hasn't
right.
been a,
well,
issue.
And there, as we know, there are some farms, you know, for example, where the barn might be in Manitoba and the house is in North Dakota across
right,
the border
right.
and things like that. So, and of course,
you know, Lake Metagoshi is too. I mean,
yeah.
some of the cabins are on the North Dakota side, some are on the Canadian side.
Correct. And of course, we are home to the International Peace Gardens, celebrating the longest peaceful, unguarded mm-hmm. border between two nations. And so we can relish that. But at the same time, I think we need to be aware someone we both admire, I think President Reagan used to say, trust but verify, you know, make sure
mm-hmm.
that peaceful
yeah.
border is maintained, but make sure that some aren't abusing it. But just to move on to a couple of other things, one of the things, and I remember you sponsored legislation on this, I believe, back during the session, and I believe there's a committee that's looking into it right now. What might be the future of nuclear power in North Dakota? Is there an opportunity there?
Yes, there is. I mean, you know, we like to say in North Dakota that we're all of the above energy policy, that we don't want to exclude or unfairly incent any form of energy, whether it's renewables or fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we don't have nuclear energy, and we haven't had the economics for having nuclear energy haven't been there historically, because we've had, you know, access to very affordable coal in our state. And, of course, we still do.
Mm-hmm.
But the technology around nuclear energy is changing so fast that it's something we ought to be looking at. Because, number one, I think nuclear energy has the benefit of having support on both sides of the political spectrum. You know, the folks that are most concerned about climate change tend to support nuclear because it's, you know, it doesn't have a carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And then folks on the other side like it because it's not intermittent, it's dispatchable, it can be used and called up when the demand is there, regardless of the conditions. So it has broad support, and the technology is such that these small modular reactors can be located closer to the where the power is consumed without having to have large transmission infrastructure, which is a major impediment to energy development in North Dakota and other states. So it's got that
right.
the main drawback of nuclear energy is its cost. We haven't been building nuclear reactors in the United States for a long time, so the supply chains aren't there, the know-how isn't there, the workforce isn't there. So, you know, the one that was recently completed, the Vogtle plant in Georgia, went way over budget, and so that's kind of got parts of the industry taking a hard look at it and say, you know, we just, until this becomes more affordable, it's not as viable as other forms of electric generation.
Mm-hmm. What the, and you know, I don't know to the degree that this is still an issue, but I think in the back of some people's minds, you know, shades of Chernobyl come to mind. And what about the safety? I think most people don't realize how safe nuclear energy really is.
Yeah, well, it's very safe. I mean, you're in Fargo there, and you've had a couple facilities. They're not in your backyard, but, you know, XL has operated two facilities, one in Red Wing and another in Monticello, Minnesota, for 45, 50 years. And they're, one in Monticello is right, you know, just right on the edge of town.
Yep.
And it's, as you drive by Interstate 94, you don't even notice it.
Yeah, it's right there. You're
but,
right.
You know, they're safe facilities. The new technology, they're even safer. Mm-hmm. The main, you know, I suppose safety concern that a lot of people seem to have is the disposal of the waste.
Correct.
And that's not a technology problem. That's more of a political problem. You know, where, who wants to store the waste, you know, with a half life of, you know, several thousand years.
Right.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
And, but most all plants are storing their waste on site. So, it's one of those things that hasn't been solved for the long term, but it has been for the life of most plants.
And some may remember the, Yucca Mountain plan years ago and when they had some leadership in the United States Congress, that was shelved, it seems. And so you're right, storage is an issue. But, you know, you mentioned coal, and for a long time, coal is out of disfavor, obviously, among many on the national level. And I don't share that view, and I know you don't either, because we operate probably the cleanest coal plants in the world here in North Dakota, and people don't realize that. And, you know, when folks talk about cap and trade and other types of things, and, of course, in the era that we live in with all the talk about the concerns about CO2 and much of which we could have a whole program on that. I won't get into all of that. But I think people need to recognize that that coal is one of the most affordable, one of the cleanest if it's done right, and one of the most dependable, reliable forms of energy generation out there. Do you see a renaissance in all? I know this administration, I mean, we know about drill, baby, drill. We know how pro-oil they are. I think they are pro-coal. Do you see, but I'm just not sure whether there's an appetite for coal-generated electricity around the country like I wish there was. What do you see the future of that being?
Well, I see a strong future for coal. I mean, I have no expertise in the coal generation industry, but I think... The ability to burn clean coal is there. It's not cost prohibitive, and I think you're going to see some shift in people's opinions about coal. Just as you've seen, there's been a dramatic shift in people's opinions about nuclear energy.
Correct.
And I think, you know, one of the things that might drive it is cost.
Yes.
I mean, you guys in Fargo are staring down the barrel of a 19.3% increase.
And we are going to be talking about
from
that.
The provider.
Exactly.
From the provider. And there are some, and I don't know whether it's true, but there are some that feel that part of the reason for those, you know, sticker shock type increases is that some companies have just sort of unwisely abandon coal as a reliable and affordable source of electricity.
Yeah,
and so that's going to change the thinking out there as well.
Well, that's really true. And if people want to read more about that, I would refer them to the website where I do a bit of writing now, and that's AmericanExperimentND.org. AmericanExperimentND.org. Sarah Montalbano, who is an energy policy fellow with the Center of the American Experiment, has written a piece there, and the title of it is "The Government Shutdown Reveals the Risk." I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. It was about coal. She said North Dakota. Apologize, reading a different headline. North Dakota pays for Minnesota's coal plant closures was her headline, and I've also written one which is entitled "Minnesota Regulators Should Not Drive Up North Dakotans' Energy Costs." And, you know, the problem is with this particular entity, XL Energy, which I have, you know, I'm served by them. I appreciate the work they do, and they're very reliable and do a great job, but they're domiciled in Minnesota. And, you know, Minnesota has this I would say, left of center regulatory process and structure, and their requirements stem from that, and I think their requirements are unreasonable when it comes to so-called renewables, and their disdain for fossil fuels, and as a result, you know, they're, for example, this is one of the things that I've always marveled. They do not allow, Minnesota does not, as I understand it, does not allow its energy companies to count hydroelectric power within their renewable portfolio. Now,
oh, you're kidding.
I don't know what's more renewable than water running over a dam, but apparently that's not considered renewable to them. And I think it's, you know, an artificial regulation just to try to force wind and solar power.
Right.
As you mentioned earlier, in North Dakota, you know, we've been kind of a all-of-the-above state, and we have no problem with, you know, with so-called renewable sources like wind and solar, but they need to be part of the mix. Not they can't dominate. I was in Germany a few years ago, several years ago now, when they were trying, the whole country was trying to go to so-called renewable energy as a standard, and they were proud of it. They were inviting people to come and see what they were doing, and it was a big push. Mm-hmm. Until they realized that it was unsustainable. It didn't work, and they had to abandon it.
Right.
And
well, either that or, you know, well, and I think this is the example. Germany is dependent, I think, on Denmark for their, you know, they want this renewable energy. Well, they've got to get a lot of their wind energy from Denmark. And I just can't think of a worse policy for the United States to increase our dependence on another foreign state.
Sure.
For our energy needs, we just can't put ourselves in that position,
right?
Because it, you know, it's come home to roost for the NATO countries,
mm-hmm.
in the Ukrainian war.
Mm-hmm.
They're
absolutely
too dependent on Russia.
Yeah.
And,
well,
you know, Trump has called them out for that, and
indeed.
It's just you can't be a sovereign state and become dependent on another country for your basic energy needs.
Absolutely. Well, and people in Europe, you know, as most people know, Europe is very different from the United States. When Europeans come here to visit, they usually say, well, you don't have a state here. You don't have a country. You have a continent. Because a lot of our states are about
right.
the size of their nations, and it's a whole different animal. But, you know, just to contrast, you know, Xcel Energy, which we mentioned, serves customers throughout in various parts of our state. I think you folks over in Minot, I think they serve
yeah.
you, and they also
Grand
serve
Forks,
us.
Fargo.
Yep, exactly.
Yep.
And of course, we have a thing called territorial integrity in North Dakota. So these lines were kind of fixed years ago between the cooperatives and the investor-owned utilities. And the theory is you can't cross the line. Once you have a territory, it's yours, and so on. And yet, you know, it's kind of a mix in terms of who serves who. But because they are regulated in Minnesota, they have these problems that we've talked about. And the PSC, as you said, has a rate case right now, the Public Service Commission in North Dakota, a request, and I think you said it's a 19% increase, to increase the rates in North Dakota. And, you know, my personal view, and it's part of what I've written, is that North Dakotans should not have to pay the freight for crazy Minnesota regulations. So if they want to impose those, have no ill will toward my Minnesota friends and neighbors, but perhaps the folks who elect the people that create those crazy regulations should be the ones paying for them, and not those of us across the border that maybe don't share that mindset. I saw something else, and go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, you mentioned the Territorial Integrity Act, and that's an act that goes back to the 1960s. And what you have to remember about that is, it sort of protects monopoly power, which we tend to think is not good in a free market system.
Correct.
But the idea is we don't want duplication of, you know, electric distribution infrastructure, because
exactly.
that would be more costly for the consumer
mm-hmm.
to have competing electric utilities going to the same home serving that last mile. Well, if you're going to start to see that type of increase
mm-hmm.
in that territory, Fargo, Grand mm-hmm. Forks, Minot, maybe there has to be a change to that territorial integrity to allow
mm-hmm.
some competition,
because that's the way it is.
That's
the way it is in Texas. They you go and compete for your for customers for utility companies just the way we do for anything else, and you're not locked in. So I think people should encourage the PSC to reject part of that effort and go forward. But well, we've touched on a lot of things we could continue to talk about. So we'll need to do this again, David. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah.
And again, appreciate all the work you're doing in the interim and your leadership in the legislature. Senator David Hogue has been with us, who is the Senate Majority Leader in North Dakota, also the Chairman of Legislative Management. Does a great job over there. And it's been great to be with you on the Steve Hallstrom Show today. Kim Koppelman signing off.